was a book called In the Days of Great Peace. The author's name had been given as Mauni Sadhu. It was a name under which an Englishman settled in Australia. He had written the book giving an account of his stay with Ramana Maharshi at Thiruvannamalai. I believe I had received the book for review, and as I took it, I was so fascinated that I don't think it required more than 2 days for me to read the whole book and write a long review article on it. I developed great admiration for the author's understanding of Indian thought, ability to communicate spiritual experience to the reader, and was thereafter on the lookout for other books. And obviously, the paper to which I had sent the review, they were so much satisfied that next year, when another book of the author, also published by Allen and Unwin, I believe, came, they sent it to me for review. It was on concentration. Very avidly, I opened the pages, but I was greatly disappointed, for after a handsome introduction to the subject, as soon as I started developing the theme, the author started analyzing, giving numbers 1, 2, 3, giving diagrams, points red, blue, white, green, to explain how concentration is to be done. It looked to me ridiculous that a dynamic process like meditation or concentration was attempted to be explained in terms of numbers and dots. It certainly can't be reduced to a system like that. It is not something of physical science, but it is a movement, a psychological process, which can be indicated, but it can't be reduced to numbers and systems. Thereafter, I have come across more books by the same gentleman, but having the same handicaps, disabilities. And I also found that other authors who normally write very well on other subjects, when it comes to explaining certain lines of Indian yoga to the Western mind, they try to reduce it to a system. And in the very process, they fail in communicating the spark. All this came to my mind when I read Sri Aurobindo's observation this morning that yoga of devotion cannot be made into a system, just as the psychological system of Raja Yoga or the physical system of Hatha Yoga can be. It is a question of love, of movement, of emotion. There is no procedure about it. It is something that wells up naturally, flows out naturally. And there is no saying you can go this way or that way. This is the path and not that path. This far and no further. It cannot be. Emotions, when it concerns emotions, when it concerns love, even in the human field, things cannot be reduced to a system. Though there are pathetic attempts by psychologists, psychoanalysts to trace cause to effect, effect to cause developments, they are only approximations of what is likely to happen, but certainly not portrayals of what is going to happen or what is bound to happen. There is always the imponderable factor when one speaks of love. It depends upon the level from which love erupts. If it is on the surface, you can analyze, you can say what could be the motives, you can say what can be the reactions of that love, satisfied or unsatisfied, requited or unrequited. But if an emotion is based deeper, somewhere within, then no system of psychology or parapsychology can visualize in a fixed way the course that movement is going to take. We can speak of movements, we can speak of phases in a broad way. Even there, when it concerns love, when it concerns devotion, you cannot make watertight compartments. One phase may come earlier in some cases, in others the other phases may come earlier. But broadly speaking, the movement of devotion in yoga, where one tries or seeks to unite with the divine through the path of love, there are four broad movements. One is the desire, the quest of the soul for the divine. Second, the pain of love, unfulfilled, unresponded, and the struggle. Third, the joy of being possessed by the divine love. One surrenders oneself absolutely, whether in the spirit, whether you respond or not, my being stands surrendered to thee. It is in this spirit that one surrenders, and the joy of being possessed, that is the third movement, that leads inevitably to the delight of possessing the divine. This is a step from being possessed. The final culmination is to possess the divine and have that eternal delight, the bliss of possessing the divine. But these shall not be regarded as inevitable procedure. They are broadly four movements. Coming to more detail, the origin of all paths of love and devotion are to be found in religions. Various religions have attempted to forge the paths to the divine through love. The first requisite is that there should be an adoration of the divine. One adores the divine from the human end. One adores what is above, what is around. And this process of adoration is organized, given expression, given shape into worship, an external worship built around an adoration of God. This worship in many religions as time passes comes to be finely woven into a system of ceremonial worship. Many stop there. They feel that once the worship is offered, once all the ritual of worship is gone through, things are done. But it is not always so. After all, it is the inner adoration that gives soul to the body that is external worship. In the Indian tradition, the external worship is considered to be only the first starting point. In the tantras, they have a broad categorization of the classes of seekers, the ordinary herd type, herd, flock type, who just do what others do, who have not crossed beyond the animal level. They are led through external modes of worship. There are other grades like the heroic type. First is the animal type, heroic type, who takes all things as they come and use them as means of communion with God. And there is the godly type, to whom everything reminds of God and everything is used only as a symbol, leaving that apart. External worship is the first step, but by no means it is a false step or a wrong step. It is very fashionable among votaries of the yoga of knowledge or the yoga of works to dismiss external worship as sheer sentimentality. Sri Aurobindo has done great service in pointing out that external worship, external mode of expressing the inner emotion, adds a certain completeness to the procedure. On the physical plane, it is a physical means of expression that stabilizes, that gives concrete shape, and helps to establish the inner relation. As one develops, as one worships, remembering that the external worship has always got to have relevance to the inner adoration, that the inner adoration is the main thing, the external worship gradually either drops out or ceases to have the same importance. An inner adoration takes its place. As the inner adoration takes root, without needing the stimulus of external worship, without needing the reminders of external ritual, as it develops naturally, as the soul slips up in adoration to the divine, in any form that one is used to, there is a natural and a spontaneous flow of life, of thought, of emotions towards the divine. This turning of the whole life towards the divine translates itself when there is a modicum of sincerity into a progressive consecration of life. There is a conscious attempt to surrender, to relate oneself at every step with the divine, whatever the work one may do, mental, physical, or any other. At every step, it is given as an offering of love to God. Things are done in that spirit, with the result that there grows a certain likeness to the divine, an important element of this discipline of self-consecration is purification. Certainly, by purification we do not mean external purification like bathing 10 times, bathing each time one offers worship or one sits for meditation, though one may certainly do it if one feels fresh thereby. But it is a conscious remolding of one's life by accepting only those elements which lead one a step further, a step closer to the divine, and eliminating those movements in us which retard our progress, which hold us back. There is what is called a catharsis, a bold washing out of the impurities from one's psychological system, so that the whole being develops into a temple where the presence is attracted by the aspiration, by the purity of the climate, and installs itself. Ethical rules are applied in determining one's conduct by some, but in many cases what happens is that ethical perfection becomes an end in itself. It leads to a sort of self-complacence that one has arrived. But there are ethics and ethics. There are norms and norms. The one barometer that is to be applied under all cases is, does this lead me nearer the divine, or does this lead me away from the divine? The first is good, the second is bad. The first promotes purity, the other promotes impurity. It is in this way of self-consecration, purification by catharsis, cultivation of movements that build up one's nature into likeness with the divine, that go in the long run to give what is called liberation into likeness. There are various kinds of liberation, and the one and capital realization of liberation into God is one when our nature develops into a likeness with the divine nature. As in the other systems, psychological or psychophysical, here too there is the question of works, there is the question of thoughts. It is easy, and it has been the tradition in many religions to withdraw from this world of human relations, regarding them as so many traps which are set up by the enemies of God, by Maya, to keep persons tied down, to regard the world as a huge snare, to withdraw into the forest or into the lonely retreat of the heart, develop relations with the Divine, and after establishing link, after living in the Divine largess, if one cares to share it with those around, with like-minded devotees, like-minded lovers of God, but that is all. In movements like Buddhists, the sphere is extended by including works of compassion, of charity, of universal kindliness, as so many flowerings of the spirit of love for God. Certainly, this way is not open to the seeker of the integral path. For us, the world is not a snare. The world is a field of God. We have to play our part in opening the field more and more completely to the play of the Divine, and ourselves participate in the manifestation. So, once we are awake to the breath of Divine love, it is up to us to let that love radiate in our relations, in our works, in our exertions, in whatever field. The whole world is looked upon as the body of God, and with the same tenderness, with the same sincerity with which one reaches one's love to God, it is reached out to God in humanity, in the world. So also in thoughts, in the mind. Thought movements which lead one away from the central preoccupation with Divine Beloved, the Divine Love, they are put in the background, and those that stimulate, those that create the mental climate favorable for the perception of Divine Oneness, for the flow of Divine Love, they are encouraged and organized. In this process, the remembrance and the repetition of a Divine Name, the use of a Divine Form, they have been found to be of capital use. We speak of name. Name is not just a label. Whatever it may have come to be in our system of life in the world originally and in the proper scheme of things, a name is something like a button, which when pressed, when uttered, releases into the atmosphere all the power, all the qualities, all the things that are in the form bearing that name. Name is a symbol, symbol of a reality which it signifies. So, if, for instance, one speaks, one repeats the name of Krishna, there is an immediate upsurge at its own level of delight. One repeats the name of Shiva, there is an outbreak of silent peace. One speaks of Mahakali, there is a dynamism. There is a power. We may not be aware, we may not be cognizant on our surface levels, but in the inner realms, the moment the name is uttered with proper attention, what stands behind that name is evoked, springs to life. Similarly, form. Form is not just an outline given by human imagination or human caprice. The contents, the charge that is inside, they take a particular shape in the subtle realm. According to the shape, one knows what is inside. So each form answers to this content of truth that is in it. That is why name and form have been given such great importance in Indian spiritual tradition. As happens in every human institution, these things have lost their original power, but they can always be tapped, they can always be utilized. There have been cases where by sheer repetition of the name, a link has been established with the divine. Whatever means, name, repetition of name, evocation of form, concentration on form, whatever it is, there is an interchange, a link established with the divine. These are the different ways in which Indian tradition has, in a sense, pictured the growth of love. But after all is said and done, there is a capital way, a most natural way, and that is the birth of love by itself. It is not that one decides, I want to realize God and I shall do it through the way of devotion, and chooses the way of love. There are many, there are some in whom there is a spontaneous awakening of love. When the soul hears the flute calls of the beloved, and it can no more be held back by the pleasures or the riches or the affluences of the flesh or the matter. It insists on leaving aside all considerations and calls and go there where is the divine beloved blowing his flute. No rules, no conventions, no traditions can hold. The breath of divine love in such cases bloweth where it chooses. There is a natural outflow. The soul passions for God. There is such an intensity, a consuming intensity of love, that one wonders whether they are on the verge of lunacy. Mother has warned number of times people here from condemning others as mad people too easily. He said, you never know whether it is a madness due to damage of brain or it is a result of certain imbalance caused in the system by the inability to establish a bridgehead between external nature, external being, and the inner growth. There is a divine madness that is followed by the period of pain, of separation. One struggles, one cries, but the divine does not manifest himself, Or if we manifest, it does not last long enough. There is the pain of separation. There is the cry of anguish, followed by repeated revelations of the beloved, till the whole system catches fire and one becomes one with the divine beloved. Indian religion has presented this truth of the human soul turning to its divine beloved in a picturesque language. It has taken all possible human relations and worked out love of man, the human soul for God, in those terms. The most misunderstood has been the relation of God as the lover. Many stories have been spread out and are being popularized, especially in the West. In India certainly nobody takes them literally, but in the West there is a sedulous attempt to promote the cult of sex under the plea of the love of human soul for God. The whole thing, let me assure you, is baseless. In the Mahabharata, in the epic where Krishna is first mentioned, the Gita is announced, where Krishna's birth, his work on earth is lauded, there is no mention of Krishna and his beloved Radha. Centuries later, a cult grew up in India on Krishna, the divine lover, and all stories naturally built up around certain physical details that must have existed were woven into a whole epic called Bhagavata. His poetic imagination is never wanting, particularly when it can be prostituted to vital needs. And whole series of scenes were conjured up. When Krishna was supposed to blow the flute and call for his nocturnal dances, the wives of poorer cowherds who left them half fed and rushed, and they all met under the skies of the moon, full moon, and danced. Stories were told how when these women were bathing in a pond, Krishna came and stole their clothes, stood on the branch, and when they couldn't find their clothes after bath, he said, "Bear yourself," and put them to shame. Now these are all, such stories are obviously grotesque. Obviously grotesque. I will tell you why. In the same epic, at an age when Krishna is supposed to have sported, dallied with these damsels, in the moonlit nights, danced with them for hours together. His age was 9. You can imagine. All those ladies were housewives with children, husbands. Now, can really sex enter into the situation? The incident of removing the clothes Is it not apparent to the meanest intelligence that it is just a symbol, symbolic story, that the human soul, when it goes into the ritual of purification, the Lord removes the vestures, takes away the vestures of desires, human emotions, lesser movements, and asks the soul to bear itself to his sight so that he may pour his grace over them. It should be self-evident. Similarly, Krishna's marrying 16,000 wives, is it a human phenomenon? These wives of the cowherds, they are gopis, they are really, they stand for so many energies, so many human natures, which have been chained to the Purusha in ignorance. God comes to give deliverance to these natures, human natures. Nature is always symbolized as female energies. It is that fact of the advent of the divine for a special intervention to give release to human souls, to give release to human natures from thraldom to ignorance and animality, that is the truth of the matter. There is no mention of Radha as pictured in the later books on the divine love at all. There is no mention in the epic. There is no mention, I believe you, in Bhagavad. It is a much later invention. And as Sri Aurobindo describes, Radha is a personification of human love, surrender to the divine. If Krishna symbolizes, embodies the divine love for humanity, for man, Radha symbolizes the love offered by the human soul in utter surrender. It pains one to see the parody that is being made of these profound truths by movements like the Hare Krishna movement. To what degradation things are being dragged down. We have seen pictures, luckily we have not seen physically, of shiploads, jet loads of devotees coming to India from America, dressed in all those outworn modes, all those heads shaven and all that, and reenacting all the pastoral, idyllic scenes of Krishna's life, full with Radha and Krishna, Gopi and Krishna, but with not a whiff of true divine love. There is a vital excitement. They get a vital thrill when they play new instruments, when they play to new tunes. I guarantee, if I get half a dozen of these people here who are habitually singers on the road singing glories of God, and if you hear them for 5 minutes, your body will begin to respond. That is because there is an element of vital thrill, and the vital thrills to it. As mother said to me once, these people mistake vital vibrations, vital excitement, vital thrill for spiritual experience. Vital experiences. The only danger in the way of love is vital deception. Be careful there, and love is the nearest gate and the easiest gate. That is my personal experience, testified 100 times. on the divine being. We have had a great opportunity to realize the truth of divine love in embodiment. To what extent the divine stoops to accept the petty human love that is offered to her in sincerity. After all is said and done, the true relation between the mother soul and the child soul is one of love. There is no question here whether one is a sinner or a virtuous man, whether one is learned or stupid. All that matters is whether one can hold here the cup of love and offer it to God. Since there are no questions that are forthcoming, I would end with one note which I have forgotten, and that is, as I said in the beginning, the path of love has to be spontaneous. It is something which cannot be governed by logic, by it cannot be systematized or methodized. India is rightly regarded as the origin of this way of love, but it has also happened that in the later ages, particularly in Bengal, some schools sprang up, schools of philosophy, which tried to reduce the way of love into a fine system. Tomes after tomes have been written in Sanskrit, annotated upon and re-annotated upon by other scholars, reducing the whole thing to a dry as dust philosophy. Time and again I have taken up these volumes, but could never proceed beyond page 2. And I would sound a note of warning. Whenever you find anybody teaching how to culture love towards God and makes a system of it, beware of it. It has to be something spontaneous. You have to allow it to form. All that you have to do is to support it, to build a climate in which love will sprout. What mother called constant state of benevolence. She was never tired of repeating that have benevolence everywhere, even to your enemy. Don't let your heart go dry or hard. The seed of love will not sprout on a barren soil. Don't be ascetic. By all means reject inferior pleasures. But don't reject life. An ascetic and divine love go ill together. There has to be a broad acceptance of things as the face of God, as the body of God. A constant state of benevolence, when one looks always to the favorable side of things, put the best favorable interpretation on things, is charitable to others, much more than what one is to oneself. And thereby, one develops a soft soil around oneself, within oneself, where the feet of the Divine Beloved can land without being hurt. The question is about an article that has appeared in a local paper envisaging a general revolution in India, the author has said that this is the hour of God of which Sri Aurobindo speaks, and people are asked to be ready. I am afraid that is not what Sri Aurobindo meant when he spoke of the hour of God. He spoke of a spiritual manifestation and not a material revolution. It is an easy way on the part of the author to think all the problems of India or the world will be solved by a revolution. He has mistaken unrest, agitation, for revolutionary upsurge. What Sri Aurobindo wanted, a revolution in thought, a revolution in spirit, is not of which the author of the article has got any conception. He thinks only in terms of social and political changes. If spirituality can be of help in upturning the existing social order, well and good. Otherwise, he is prepared to upset even spirituality. This is the usual way of academic thinkers or disappointed politicians. The causes of today's unrest are not simply political, are not simply social mismanagement. They are much deeper. There is unrest everywhere in every field because of the inability or the unwillingness of man to respond to the pressure of the time spirit, which is to break out of his ego shell, universalize himself before he is ready to receive the transcendent consciousness in himself. That is the main crux. Man should change. Unless individuals start changing in their own lives, start forming collectivities promoting this change, this period of unrest will continue, and talk of impending revolution also will continue.
Buddha has been said to have infinite compassion, and it's a word infinite which strikes me a little because it's quite absolute. You think that means that we should accept everything from the other with absolute forgiveness?
Pardon, repeat the question. If one is concerned only with one's own spiritual development, then this counsel of perfection, to treat everything that comes from others with absolute forgiveness, is commendable. But remember, the ultimate aim of Buddha was to withdraw from life. He was concerned to heal the wounds of life of others as much as possible. But the end was always to withdraw. But in a scheme, in a perspective, which intends to build up life, to develop life into a picture of perfection into a pattern of divine manifestation, one has necessarily to employ one's discrimination. See what are the elements of ill will in another's reaction. What are the saving elements? One has to take note. One has to protect oneself against the evil vibrations and encourage the good and the holy vibrations. But always one must note the wrong side of things, but not allow it to determine our entire attitude. One must note, one must send corrective vibrations, physical or psychological or spiritual, guard oneself against them, and then get on. It is a double labor for a spiritual seeker who believes in the perfection of life. It is more difficult than for a follower of Buddha.